Nobody can take your integrity away from you. They cannot do that. But you can give it away by how you conduct your life. It's just how you conduct your life. Like I say, one of my chief goals is to make every kid that works with me successful. I want them to be successful in life. I want them to be successful when we're working together. And I'll do whatever I need to do to bring them to that point, you know. Maybe I mentioned this before, but I'm not going to miss tuning pianos one day, but I'm going to miss all the people that I've gotten to know over the years. I'm not going to miss logging one day, but I'm going to sure miss all the good times that we had doing whatever we were doing. I think about what people have left to me that went ahead of me and how important it was what I saw in their life as it kind of determined who I became. And so, and that is what I hope by the time their parents and grandparents, they look back and say, now I know why that guy was in my life.
Well, hello, listeners of the Simply Overcoming podcast. How are you? Today's episode is going to be a bit different from our typical episodes. This episode is a legacy piece. Now, it's a little longer than other episodes, but I trust you will find it interesting and enlightening. This episode is very, very close to my heart. So, all right, let's get to it. Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Aaron, and it's another episode of the Simply Overcoming podcast. Thank you for coming back. If you've listened to episodes in the past, we really appreciate you coming back to hear more. We hope that we are adding value to your life. Today's guest has been an influence in my life. He has been a mentor who has taught me things like problem solving, the importance of having a strong work ethic and integrity. I have been anticipating this episode ever since I started this podcast, and I am beyond honored to have him on the show today. This man has truly been a part of shaping me into the man I am today. Mike, Paul, we have finally made this happen. and thank you for being on the podcast today.
Yes. Thank you, Aaron.
So, first of all, Mike, I just want to hear from your side briefly how you met me.
Oh, good. And that's where I want to start it too.
Me too. I feel like we need to cover this right now.
I still have a perfect memory of that. My memory for things a long time ago is pretty good. My memory for what happened yesterday has disappeared into the ether, the short-term memory. But yes, I was on my timberland working on a main road that crossed the mountain. And along came Aaron and his older brother, Jeff, on bikes. And they stopped. My guess is they were probably about, I'd say Aaron might have been about 10 years old at that time, roughly speaking. And they stopped and talked to me a bit. And at one point, Aaron said, "Hey, do you know there's a cabin down there in the woods?" I said, "Nah, you're kidding me." He said, "No, we've seen it." And of course, it was my place where I lived. And at one point, when they left, they said, "Hey, if you ever need any help, let us know." Well, I think it was probably about 3 years later. I don't know, it was when I started tuning their piano. But I went to their home and I said, "Would you boys like a job, Aaron and Jeff?" And they said yes. And that started what was a many-year relationship. And we had a good work relationship, and I've been very, very thankful for that. The hard part is, well, the good part is when they get up around 15 years old or so, they're faster than I am, they're stronger than I am, and then by the time they hit their early 20s, they need a full-time job, and that when they're the most valuable is when they leave. But Aaron did stay on for some time, and God gave him a really special skill. I learned early on when we were felling trees and I think it was like the first year when he was about 13 years old. A tree went over the bank, and I needed to have somebody crawl out there and put the tape on the end of it. He's like, the end of it was like 15 feet off the ground, and Aaron just skittered right out there and hooked that tape. I said, "Here's a guy who has no fear of heights." And so eventually we got Aaron some climbing gear, and another boy who had worked for me taught him to climb trees. And he's pruned up, I don't know, probably several hundred for me over the years. But it's just, Aaron has been a real blessing. And that's how that all started.
Yeah, that's right. And I remember that day. And in fact, when I started working for you, I was 11 years old. So I may have even been eight or nine when we came through the woods and met you there.
Yeah.
And we had gone down and found the cabin a few weeks earlier. We were just exploring in the woods and ran into your cabin in the woods. And we just assumed that it was this abandoned cabin out in the middle of the woods. But, you know, it's what an incredible experience to meet you in the woods. Yeah. So, you know, I would really like to take it all the way back because I want to talk to you about your life. And I'd like to take it back to the very beginning. If you can briefly talk about where you were born, your family situation. And I know that something happened in your life that made you have to grow up quickly. And so I'd like to hear about that as well.
I do want to say one thing first in thinking of when we met. And I don't believe there's any such thing as luck, coincidence, or accident. I believe God has appointments for us in life. He puts us into people's life for a time and for a purpose, or he puts other people in my life for a time and for a purpose. But there's always some purpose in that. And that's how I see, that's one of the ways that I see life. So I don't think it was any accident that we met or that we've had the years that we've had together to do. And not just working in the woods, but man, in the summer we'd go backpacking trips, we'd go camping, go up to Canada, and dude, we just did a lot of really neat things together. And then finally, because I had taken up downhill skiing when I was in my 60s, I asked the boys if they'd like to come along, and three of them, and including Aaron, they chose snowboarding. But I think we even made at least one trip up into Canada to go snowboarding, right, and skiing.
Yep, right? We did.
So there was a lot more to it than that, and I always looked at our times. We would take breaks at lunch. And since I was a teacher, we were always kind of doing some kind of teaching of some kind or another. If it wasn't English, it was sharing things from God's word. And that's how I see relationships for that purpose.
Yeah, we did so much more than just work together. Our work relationship and friendship was equally strong. And something that you taught us was, you know, there is a time for work and there is a time for good times and play. And, and you know, we knew when it was working time, and we knew when it was time to have a good time. And you were always very specific about teaching us the importance of that.
And I, you know, since we're talking about that, the thing too, I remember a logging job going on near me one time, and the guy says, "Mike, you know, nobody under 18 is supposed to be within 100 feet of operating equipment." I said, "Are you kidding? The kids that work with me, they run all of the equipment. I usually teach them to work a chainsaw when they're about 13. We all have all the safety equipment on, and then they learn how to drive the cat and the truck. And, you know, like I say, by the time they're 15 or 16, they can do everything that I can do, only they're much quicker and stronger." So that is it.
When I was 14 years old, I remember you taking the keys to your truck. I don't know, maybe the keys were already in the truck, and you just said, "Aaron, I need you to take the truck and drive it up to the house." And you said, "I'm going to start walking. Give me a 5-minute head start because I don't want to be around when you drive it. I don't want to see what happens." Yeah. And I'd never really driven a manual before. And also it was parked on an extremely steep hill. And so you took off towards the cabin so that you wouldn't see what happened.
Yeah. Well, I always felt that way about everything. If I would teach you how to do something, how to limbing, what we would work with it a little bit. And then I'd let you just do it alone for a while. I'll get away from you. So, because you know, there's a learning curve to everything. Those reality shows where I don't like watching them at all, because they chew up the greenhorns and make life miserable. I mean, who's going to work with somebody like that? You know, what I always think is one of my goals in life is to help people be successful. And I want to see the boys that work with me become successful. Also, I also would teach them how to make decisions, to let them make the decision. And a lot of times we'd make decisions together, but oftentimes by the time, again, like they were in their middle 18s, they'd be telling me how we were going to do things. I thought, that is great. That is just great. All right. Well, you had another question about life and when
I was a kid. Talk to me a little bit about when, you know, where you grew up and your family situation and all that stuff.
Well, I grew up on a southwest part of Spokane. My dad had a lumberyard and hardware store, and our house was attached right to it. So I grew up playing in the office of the lumberyard and in the hardware store and out in the lumberyard. And I was born in 1943. So we're time I, you know, was at the playing ages, it was probably around 1950 or so. We lived right next to the railroad tracks that coming into Spokane. And this is still when they had those black engines, you know, the steam engines. And I can remember, they would stop off and outside, right outside our home, because there's a hill coming up. And then when they would start up, you'd hear that steam blowing and whatnot. And there was also on the boxcars, there would be guys riding on them, sort of like hobos. That was really pretty common people. That's how the guys would travel. But I walked to school. It was about three blocks away. I loved school. I just, to me, school was a lot of fun. And, you know, in those days, too, nobody worried about where you were. You'd go out at night and play in the street. And in our area where I lived, there was a number of Japanese people and black people, and we all played together, and nobody thought anything about it being unusual. It was just life, you know. But then, when I was about 11 years old, late in the summer, the railroad company would come along and they'd burn all the grass alongside the tracks. Well, after they did that one time at night, the fire came up into the lumberyard and burned the lumberyard down. Oh. In fact, I've got a photograph of a turned up on the front page of the Spokesman Review. Well, we had a lot of smoke damage in the house. We ended up moving out to the valley. So my junior high years and early high school years were spent out in the Spokane Valley in the Central Valley District. If I could carve 3 years out of my life, it would be seventh, eighth, and ninth grade. Why I did what I did, I do not know. But I created grief for my poor dad because I was in trouble a lot at school. It seems like I was just there to mess up the works for people. I could, if I wrote a book, there'd be a whole chapter on all the stupid things I did in the seventh, eighth, and ninth grades. You don't want to hear about it, really. You don't want to hear about it.
I wanted to ask you, was this back when the streets in Spokane were brick?
Yes, they were right out in front of our place. They were brick. Hmm. And it's interesting now because where I lived is right across the street from now is a, like a homeless shelter, a place where they give out things to them. So oftentimes when they show that notice, I say, I know that street. It's right outside where we used to live. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
The thing that kept me out of serious trouble in junior high and early high school was band. I took up the drums, and that was my life. Percussion was my life for about 35 years, and I loved basketball. I wanted to be a professional basketball player when I grew up, and I worked really, really hard at it. I think... of course, it wasn't going to happen. It was one of those things that was, it didn't take long. By the time I was a junior in high school, I realized I was never going to be a professional basketball player. One of the big changes that occurred in my life, for the good, actually, it was when I was 16. We had a lake place out at Twin Lakes also where we would spend the summers. And Dad started a small lumberyard. That's actually where my house is right now here at Twin Lakes right at the channel. And Dad wanted me to come up and work in the lumberyard when I was about 15 or so. And all I wanted to do is go play and water ski with my friends. I really didn't want to do any that kind of work. And then Dad got sick. He went into the hospital in the fall of my junior year of high school. And he turns out he had cancer. They first gave him, thought he might live for about two more years, and then they figured maybe about 6 months. Well, he was gone at the end of the week, so it was very sudden. Well, I believe the Lord took him home for my sake because it turned my life around. Seriously, I became responsible at school and did a lot better at school, and... For several summers, I ended up running that lumberyard out at Twin Lakes. Started when I was 16 years old at a lumberyard and hardware store. And Mom says, you're too young. You can't go out and do that. I said, goodbye, Mom. Hmm. And I went out there, and I learned how to do it. And then I stayed in the cabin that we had across the lake. I batched. It was, I would say, everything I learned about finances, I learned between the ages of 16 and 20. And the Lord put a number of people in my life to help, too. And one of the things I learned about finances was never to be in debt. So I have, the closest I've ever been into debt was when we built the home here. We borrowed some money, and I'll tell you about at some point who we borrowed it from, who I borrowed it from. But I was able to get out of that in 4 years. And since that time, if I can't pay cash for something, I don't get it, which has been a really a blessing.
Something that's very rare in our society today.
Yes. After that is my college years, and that's then it starts becoming a whole new chapter of my life. But at this point in my life, I was not a Christian. You know, still, I had what I would call a God consciousness. But I wanted to do well. I wanted to do well in school, and say I did a lot of contest drumming competition, but I loved playing. And also, we had played in a quartet dance band. And in fact, I still tune for the pianist that we had in that group. We did a lot of high school dance jobs, junior proms, senior balls, and we had just a lot of fun with that. A lot of jazz that we would do, yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the lumber yard. You know, so your dad passes away, your father passes away, and you're left with this lumber yard. And obviously, like you said, you weren't paying attention very much when he was alive. And so, you know, how was that transition in your life from going from, you know, playing and on the lake and doing what you wanted to running the lumber yard? What were the challenges, the struggles, and what were some of the things that helped you along the way?
Yes. Well, in those days, there was no such thing as a Lowe's or a Home Depot. You didn't go in and buy a 2x4 or 1x12 by the piece. You had to convert it to board feet, so much per thousand. So there was a lot of math involved in that. A board foot is a board that's 1 inch thick, 12 inches wide, and 12 inches long. So it would sell so much per board feet. And it was all done by the thousand. So there was a lot of mathematics involved in that. And there was a piece of paper Dad left in the desk that showed how to convert to board feet. That saved my life. Although one time I made a huge blunder. I sold a whole load of 2x10s to a guy for 1x10s because I forgot to double it for the two. And I was so embarrassed about it, I didn't go and tell him. So he got a deal of a lifetime. The one good thing about it is the lumberyard was well stocked and the hardware store. And of course, this is a small one at Twin Lakes. Mom leased out the one that was in Spokane.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the guy couldn't pay the lease. So Mom went to work. In those days, if you were self-employed like my dad was, you didn't have to have Social Security, and he didn't have that. And I think it was the best thing for my mom because she went to work for like 20 years after that.
Did that just give her a purpose in life? Is that why you say it was so important and so good for her?
Yes, yeah. It gave her something to do and look forward to, and she enjoyed the work that she did. We were living out in the valley. She drove downtown and clerked in some of these older hotels where elderly people lived, and she just really enjoyed that. And eventually she moved into Spokane and worked at the Deaconess, the hospital, for quite a while. And then eventually she remarried one of her brother-in-laws. Her sister died, and she was married to him for 28 years. So she had 25 years with my dad and 28 years with somebody else, and lived to be 97.
Wow.
So that was that. But challenges in the lumberyard. Golly, you know, the Lord put so many people in my life that were helpful. One was an FBI agent, lived right up the road from here, and I learned a really, really important lesson from him. And he became a lifelong friend as long as he was alive. John Bowker, he looked like an FBI agent, just tough-looking guy. In fact, one time he ended up catching a bank robber on the streets of Spokane. He said the most difficult situation they would go into would be like if they were going into a cabin on Coeur d'Alene Lake, something like that, and some guy is holed up in the cabin, and you don't know if you're going to open a closet door and get blown away or whatnot. He said those were the most dangerous things. But he had a cabin up a road from me, and he would come down and help me at the cabin. In fact, we used to go to auctions together, and we would get materials for the lumberyard. He would bid on them, but he kind of helped me kind of organize things in the yard. But I also, since I was going to be starting college, I had to be careful that I didn't have too much inventory at the end of the year or things tied up because I needed enough money to go to college. But actually, after the first year and a half, I spent 11 years in college. The rest of it didn't cost me anything.
Oh, my.
Scholarships and fellowships. I learned the importance of getting good grades. But the lesson I learned from John was, he said, he ordered a load of lumber and supplies, and he says, when can we meet? I said, well, we'll meet you at 1 o'clock on whatever day it was. I dilly-dallied around and didn't get there at one time. Probably got there at 1:30, and there was a note on his door. He says, Mike, he'd be here at 1 o'clock, so I'm canceling the order. I was mortified by that. And he told me later on, he says, you know, in what I do, where I do, I have to do a lot of interviews with people on investigations. It's important that when you say you're going to be there at that time, you be there at that time. That was I haven't always done that, but I've always tried to do that, to be on time. I learned that. By the way, he eventually reordered the order.
But, did he?
But that one stuck with me. In fact, it stuck with me so well. What I do is, I think probably from the time I was about 18, I've always kept my clocks 15 minutes ahead so I won't be late. Of course, you probably know what the problem with that is. Pretty soon you start interpolating. I say, well, it's really this amount of time, but still try to do that.
I'm remembering that now. I had forgotten about how you kept your watches set like that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that all of the people in your life that helped you along the way, mm-hmm. is that what sort of motivated you, gave you the desire to help young people in the future when you had the land and you had young people coming and working with you and teaching them how to work?
I think some of it goes cleared back to, my dad was 50 when I was born. Uh-huh. So here I am 10 years old. My dad is 60 years old. We never did anything together, like run out and play. And I said, you know something? When I get married, we're going to have our children when I love, because I want to grow up and I want to play with the kids and do stuff with them. And he did. We had a good time growing up together. And when they got older and then I started to miss that, that's when I started having other boys come. And I said, well, why not just keep right on going? I'll just borrow somebody else's kids and be there kind of away. Not their dad, obviously, but just kind of continue what I was doing with my own kids. And then I think probably, I say in 1965, when I became a Christian, I was always working with kids at school, and I just really enjoyed that. I thought, man, this is, I'll love doing this the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And probably it was at some point I realized that there was an opportunity to have a godly influence on them. And for me, that was really important, I think. Mm. But I also had to see that I was fallible, make mistakes and foul things up too. Trying to think of that thing with the lumberyard, I did it for several years. And then finally, I sold the buildings off of it, and it was an empty lot until we built our home here.
Wow.
But there was all the intervening things where I ended up living with the people we bought the timberland from. That's a whole nother chapter of life.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit about your college years, but before we do. I had one last question, and this is sort of a random question, but it has to do with the history of this place. A lot of people may not know there used to be some train tracks that came right out to the end of Twin Lakes.
Yes, in fact, you drive across them when you go to your home. It came down out of the off of Mount Spokane, and it went out to Seasons Road, right where there used to be an overpass, a bridge, which they've taken out since that time. Yes,
wow.
There were tracks there, and when I was a little boy, and we bought this cabin across the backside of Twin Lakes, I was probably about 6 or 7 years old. I remember coming down here, and there was a big sawmill right where my home is right now. And it was loud. And for a little kid, it scared me. And I can remember along the road out here was a giant pile of slabs, you know, but down towards the lake was the mill part of Baird and Andorf. And there were, at that time, there were still boats on the lake, tugs that would bring log booms down the lake. And then, of course, that eventually was all torn down and gone. But a lot of history in the area around logging. Yeah.
Yeah, I always found that very fascinating. And I know there's so many people who have no idea that there was, you know, a train that ran through here.
Yeah.
And that was specifically for the logging.
Yes.
Yeah.
Brought the logs out. And it had a similar thing at Spirit Lake. There they had a log flume that came down, and there's still remnants of that there. And there was a very large sawmill at down at the foot of the lake below Spirit Lake Town. And,
okay.
And got taken out by a fire in the 1930s.
Really? Okay. So, okay, let's transition into your college days. You were in college for quite a few years. You got many degrees. We were just talking about this before we started the podcast.
Yes. You know, I have one deep regret from high school, and that is that I never took typing. I don't know how I got out of high school without typing, but I two-finger typed my way through college, and that's probably why I don't text much now, because it's too slow. I'm so used to using a phone. In the foyer of the dorm that I lived in, the dorms were in ways that could be two dorms connected together. Up on the wall, they had a list of all the kids who were on the honor roll and what their GPA was. I looked at that. I said, I want to be on that. That kind of motivated me to do really, really well, really well. Back then, it cost about $600 a semester for room and board and everything.
Oh my gosh.
Of course, and I had two scholarships out of high school for about $100 and $100 and a quarter, which, you know, that didn't leave a whole lot. And so the lumberyard money paid for the rest of it. Well, let's see. I mean, I told you I went as a percussionist, a drummer. And it turned out there was no percussion instructor. So I wanted to be a band director. And so I knew I was having to take music theory, and I knew that from the summer before. And so my drum instructor gave me a music theory book, and I kind of studied that as I went through. But I also, because I was a percussionist, I understood the keyboard layout because I played the vibes and I played a marimba. I could do that. But I did not play the piano. I think when I was a kid, I took piano lessons for a very short time. But I found out there was no percussion instructor. I thought, well, one of the main reasons I came here was to take percussion, you know. Plus, I found the other drummers in the band weren't so interested in doing all the things I wanted to do and work up some special things to do with the percussion. So I decided to take piano lessons. Mm-hmm. Well, you had to go in and do an audition to find out where they were going to place you. Well, I knew where I was going to get placed at the beginning, whatever the lowest number 100 would be. So what I did is I worked out, in fact, I just heard it today because I fixed a piano for the girl. She played the beginning of the Moonlight Sonata, Beethoven's Sonata. It's really quite easy. And I kind of toughed it out, the first page. So I went in, I sat down, there's five professors in there, and I'm totally unintimidated at all by this at this point. I didn't know enough to be afraid. I sat down, I played it, and the main piano prof says, well, how did you do that? Take lesson? I said, no, I taught it. And they kind of laughed about it, and they said, okay, who wants him? Dead silent. Nobody said a thing. And after about 15, 20 seconds, Dr. Stout said, I'll take him. There's another major change in my life. Dr. Stout was the chairman of the music department. He was also a piano tuner, so I think you can see what's coming there. And he was the perfect person for me. I just loved practicing. It was usually 5 hours a day. I didn't have a girlfriend, so there was no distractions in the evening, and the studies went pretty easily for me, so I spent hours and hours practicing the piano. There was a place called Agony Hall. It was an old wood structure where all the practice rooms were. And it was agony because if you were walking by from outside, you could hear all of the confusion from all the instruments being played. But he had a really neat player grand piano in there. And I got to practice on that. And then I would play the rolls on that player piano. It was a very sophisticated kind of a player. I got one years later on in life. But that was the beginning of a really long relationship. About the middle of my second year, they asked me to come and live with them. They had another boy. They always had somebody living with them at their home. This boy was from Japan, the other boy at that time. But he has also started to build a new home. Well, remember how I told you earlier on, you either buy wholesale or you buy retail in those days. And in fact, when I had the lumber yard, one of the reasons I dealt with cash is I really didn't understand checks, but I figured I could not go into a wholesale house in Spokane as a 16-year-old kid and that they're going to sell me something on credit or something. So I always dealt with cash.
Okay,
But I was able to help them get a lot of materials for their home. wholesale because I had the lumber yard. So I was able to help him on building that. But eventually, Dr. Stout taught me to tune pianos, and that became another whole part of my life. But the first 5 years were spent at WSU. It didn't take me very long to realize I was not going to be a band director, but I loved music theory, so I ended up majoring in music theory. I went on for a fifth year, I got a Bachelor of Arts in Music, and then I got a Bachelor of Music. The fifth year was mostly, there were a number of us students who would get together, four or five of us, and get a piano or get a prof to work with us on a special project. We did that the whole year, and then we would present these projects to each other. So, and I applied to graduate school, and I think I applied to three graduate schools, the University of Washington, Ohio State University, and a conservatory back on the East Coast. They offered me a teaching assistantship at Ohio State. And just before I said yes to take it, in came an offer from the University of Washington for a fellowship. Well, the difference is in a teaching assistantship, you're required to teach. You get paid a little bit, enough usually to cover your schooling, or at least a good part of it. A fellowship is just an outright grant to you. So in those years, it was $1,800 the first year, $2,000 the second, and $2,300 the third year. That paid for everything you needed, our rent, which was $75 a month, you know. And so I grabbed that, and we went to Seattle. Yeah, there's a whole another aspect to this too, and that's marriage.
Yes,
married life. Because
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah. So anyway, there was 5 years at WSU. Then there was 3 years at the University of Washington, and I did a lot of performing. Most of my time was besides working on a degree, and I was in a program that bypassed the master's. He went straight to a PhD. I had troubles with the fellow that I worked with on my dissertation. I made a blunder. I thought with that fifth year I had at WSU that I knew about writing. And this fellow who oversaw my dissertation was the person who taught the writing class. And he just gave me all kinds of griefs. And so I ended up working with another fellow who worked very, very well. So I went back to WSU. Now they had a percussion instructor, me, and music theory and history. And so I stayed there another 3 years. But then there are a lot of politics in college teaching. I think I'm not sure I want to spend my life doing this. Plus, I like North Idaho a whole lot more, so I got an elementary ed degree. Worked on elementary, so I was teaching in the music department. I was teaching percussion lessons, ensemble, and then I had a music theory class and a music history class. Until I left, and we moved up here, and we rented for a number of years before we built a house here.
Where were you renting from? Out of curiosity.
There were some folks at the east end of Spirit Lake that we knew. They had a daylight basement, and they were the postmaster and postmistress of Spirit Lake. And somehow, I don't remember. Oh, we got to know them through the church that we were going to in Spirit Lake. And they said, we'll rent your basement for the winter. We don't use it. And it was perfect because we had to leave the mountain, usually at the end of October when the water froze. And then we would move down there, and we'd move back up to the cabin. We did that for a number of years. And then one year we rented somebody's home on the highway side of Spirit Lake. Then we built our home.
Okay. Did you meet your wife before or after you started working up on the mountain for the gentleman up there?
Yes, before. Yes. Yeah. My life, our life could be a soap opera. I kid you not. On one of those band tours that we took when I was in high school, we went to Eisenhower High School in Yakima. And so I was a president of the band. I got to stay with the president of the band there, Jim Skordahl. And he became a good friend because he came to WSU. The year that I started WSU, a lot of really fine musicians from all over Washington came. And so it was a great experience with these people. But so we played this concert in the afternoon. We're going to do another concert at night. And Jim said, he says, there's this flute player in our band. She would really like to meet you. So that night we went out to an ice cream joint in Maryland. I was smitten the moment I saw her. Of course, I know, what do you call that?
She was very attractive.
Very attractive.
Yeah.
So she was only a sophomore.
Uh-huh.
So I waited for her when I went to college for 2 years. that was why I could practice piano 5 hours a day and have any distractions at night. We were going to get married, and her dad owned a music store in Yakima. They eventually moved to Edmonds, Washington. But in fact, these folks said, if you want to elope, we'll give you $500, but if you wait until you graduate, we'll give you a wedding. Well, so we really kind of tied it on that when she showed up. But I wasn't in the band any longer because the credits were so little for the amount of time I needed to put it more into academic subjects. In the spring, she came home from band tour on the arm of another guy.
Oh, no.
I was crushed. I mean, here I am with this melancholy temperament. And I would have to say it was a dark period of my life. I came a hair's breadth from suicide, to kid you. I went up on the mountain. I was going to end it. Mm. That close, Aaron. I kid you not. I'm glad I didn't. There'd be a whole bunch of grandchildren and children that would be unhappy if that had happened. But
what stopped you?
You know, I wasn't a Christian yet, but I believe the Lord graces us out in areas. However he reached me, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I didn't. And I know it will never happen again because there's I've learned too much since that. And I have known a number of people that have taken their lives. I thought, they have no idea what they missed. So, but it was there then. So I do understand how that can happen. But
sure.
A lot of it is that melancholy temperament that's prone to, you know, up and down the roller coaster. I believe it was probably the beginning of the next year. We had what were called convocations, where if you were taking lessons, you played at least once a semester or twice a semester. And it was a regular class, and everybody go to it. It was like an hour concert every week. You got to hear other kids play. This girl came out with long brown hair and played a Brahms intermezzo. That was it. And she was a friend of my roommate at that time. I remember I told you Stouts always had somebody else living with them.
Yes.
And this boy came from Cuba. And his folks owned a hardware store in Cuba. And when Castro came in, everybody thought he was going to free the country. But that's not what happened. Went the other direction. And he ended up escaping out of that country. Went into Mexico, came up, spoke very little English, but he was a very fine pianist, was how he ended up at the Stouts also. But Larry Martinez, there was a group of these kids that ran together. And Ann was one of them. And he kind of made the introduction for me. So Ann and I spent quite a bit of time together. The next year, I think it was probably the next year, would have been my fifth year, I realized we were having difficulties. I thought, you know, this is not really working very well. So she lived in Seattle, was going to come over for a wedding. And I was going to go to this wedding with her, a friend of hers, which we did. And I was going to tell her at that time, I think maybe it would be best if we ended terminated the relationship. What happened next? What happened next is improbable. After the wedding, I said, do you want to go get married? She said, yes. We drove over to Coeur d'Alene. I went to a drugstore and bought a $3 diamond ring. We went to the hitching post and got married. And she left and went back to Seattle. And I think it was about 2 weeks before school, and I went back to school. We never told anybody. I think I know somebody else who did something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know who you're talking about, Mike.
Okay, good. Anyway, so our first year of marriage, Ann still lived in the dorm with a good friend of hers. And I, at this point now, I was in an apartment with two good friends. That was the first year. And at one point, I told her, I says, Ann, we need to tell your folks what we've done, and, you know, and get living together. She said her dad worked for Boeing in Seattle, but he got transferred down to Louisiana. This was during the time when the SST, supersonic transport, kind of crashed and burned for Boeing. Anyway, they moved him down there, but he was going to end up coming back up to Seattle. She says, let's wait until this next summer, and then we'll get married in a church. Neither one of us are Christians, but we're going to get married in a church, okay? And that's what happened, and that's when I was at the University of Washington as a grad student. So I can't remember what your question was, but that's how Ann came into my life. She was a teacher, and mm-hmm. I was a teacher. We were both teachers. She's a very fine pianist and flute player, and she taught all our kids piano lessons, and flute lessons. I did tell one person that first year, and it was my piano teacher. And by this time, I was working with a different piano teacher, the main piano teacher, rather than Dr. Scout. And it was years later before I started telling everyone, our kids and whatnot, because by this time, I mean, who cares? But it was like starting a race and falling down in the first 3 feet. It was not the way to start out a marriage.
Problematic.
But we were together for 29 years, and then Anne, what I call, struck out her own. That was 28 years ago.
Okay.
28. So I've lived alone for 28 years. Mm-hmm. I think of Anne as having gone on a long vacation. But she did remarry a few years ago and lives half of the year in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then half of the year in Seattle. So, I always wanted a good marriage. From the time I was 15 years old, I was ready to get married. And somehow we did. The one thing I think we were able to do well was raise our children.
Mm.
They all turned out well. Very, very thankful for that. But somehow the good marriage escaped us. And that's when you talk about that's the major failure in my life. Mm-hmm. Major failure. What I have learned is how to be content. I know all the verses on contentment.
Mm-hmm.
It also helps to have a couple of good dogs. So it goes. Yep.
I want to talk to you about the mountain, because that is a part of your life that I have experienced. Oh, yeah. A very small part of your life on the mountain.
Well, it would start with when Dad was in the hospital dying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he had no idea that I was going to end up going out and running at a lumber yard, because I had no interest in it, you know, seemingly no interest. But he did say, you know, there's a fellow who has bought a load of materials, but he lives down in California during the winter. He was a mailman in Beverly Hills, of all things, to all of the stars and whatnot. And he said, somebody's going to have to deliver that load. In the lumberyard, I had a pickup truck, a 49 International pickup truck. It was an old Bell telephone truck. It's the first vehicle I drove off to college in. And we had a big flatbed truck, big flatbed for hauling big, heavy loads of stuff. And sure enough, the next spring, Cecil Briscoe shows up, elderly fellow, and he wanted his materials delivered. And he said, how much are you going to charge me? And I said, well, how far away is it? He says, about 5 miles. I says, nothing, I'll deliver it for free. He didn't tell me it was going to be up this mountain over through a saddle and down into Spirit Lake, but that was the beginning of a very long relationship. He bought a lot of stuff from me. He was remodeling his house. He and his wife lived there. They had 6 children, but they were all grown and living in various parts of the country and the world. The cabin that we had across the lake that I lived in, it started having some problems with a leaky roof, and Mom didn't want to deal with it, so she sold the cabin. So now I don't have anywhere to live. So Briscoe said, would you like to come and live with us at the cabin, and you could work for room and board? And I said, sure. So he required 3 hours a day. He says, that's what it is in California. He always compared everything to what it was in L.A. It was interesting going to the store with him. He also was hard of hearing, so he talked really loudly. Everybody within 50 feet could hear him. And he'd say, well, I can get it for this much in California. meaning much less. But they were really good to me, and I ended up doing a lot of remodeling work in there. In fact, there's a whole story about horse logging that I did, which is a fascinating story that goes with the timberland. But I had all this timber that I logged with a big workhorse into cedar paneling, ended up paneling his whole inside of his house, and the ceilings and whatnot. This place had been abandoned somewhere in the 1940s. It had been homesteaded in the 30s. So when they bought it, about 1949, it had been vandalized, and all the walls were covered like with wallpaper, and it was all cracking. And it was really interesting putting the ceiling up, because pack rat droppings would kind of filter down onto you. But it was a good time. And he said he would pay me for anything I did over 3 hours a day. So I got this little book, and I kept tracking. Oftentimes, it was 10 hours a day. And they had a piano in there, too, so I could practice the piano and then work.
You just throw something out like horse logging, and then we just leave it. And I have got to ask you about the horse logging. Did you have any idea what you were doing when you went in to...
Did I have any idea what we were doing? This is a... Well, you know where Twin Lakes Village is.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, back then it was the Percy Cochran Ranch. Percy Cochran is another interesting old, kind of an old-timer fellow. When you'd go down into his ranch there, he had some huge ponderosas, really neat. Most of them were taken out when they put the golf course in down there and whatnot. But he had names. I've always wanted to do this, but he had names on the trees for his friends. He named the trees after his friends. But I noticed there were these great big horses out in the field, and I thought, you know, again, you buy wholesale and you sell at retail, and I bought all my lumber from sawmills, and I thought, what if I got that horse and Briscoe let me cut some timber off his land and could log it out, and I could saw it out, and I could cut out the middleman and do really, really well. Well, my friend John Bowker, the FBI agent, he loaned me a chainsaw, and I had a friend, Dave Larson. He was my good friend from high school. We went in there and told, it was a guy, the guy who owned the horses, actually a guy who worked for Percy Cochran that owned him. And he told him, I said, we would like to do some horse logging on this land at Spirit Lake. And is there any chance we could, you know, rent one of your workhorses? Who in his right mind is going to let a couple of kids take their workhorse several miles up the road and over the mountain? Well, he said yes.
Apparently, that guy.
Yeah, he did. And he said, "You know how to put the harness on?" Oh yeah, yeah, we do. I had no clue as to how to put a harness on. But he dumped his whole load of, you know, leather stuff on the back of the flatbed truck, and Dave got on the back of the horse, which is, you know, really wide. We rode that thing almost 5 miles from a house here. Another 2 or 3 miles, 8 miles, he rode that horse up and over the mountain. Well, I'd already had cut the logs. The logs were ready. They just needed to be skidded. The horse's name was Blue. So we put the harness on, figured out how to get that on, and then there's a piece of wood called a single tree that goes behind the horse, and then your cable behind that. It keeps the reins, all the stuff away from the horse getting tangled up in it, the single tree. We went backed up the hill with the horse, hooked him up to the log. Get up, Blue. And he pulled these big logs like they were nothing, just right down the hill. Well, it wasn't a straight trail. It kind of turned. And when it turned, I tried to slow him down because there was a stump in front of us. He didn't slow down. He just kept right going. The log went into the stump and snapped that single tree in half. I thought, why didn't he stop? I don't know, but we went down to Briscoe's, and he had a shed. That was unbelievable. Whatever you needed, he had in that shed. And he had a couple of single trees hanging up on the wall. And so he gave us both single trees. We took back, hooked him back up, hooked the horse back up, got the log down, went up to get the second log down. On the way down, whoa, whoa, whoa. And he didn't whoa again and snapped the second single tree. Now we're in trouble. So we looked it over. What somehow we're doing something wrong. What we did not have to do, the reins that I held on were not hooked up to the bit in his mouth. So once we did that, it solved the problem, and we ended up skidding the rest of those logs out. What never occurred to me to do was to hire a self-loading truck to come up and get those logs. We figured out a jimmied a way to get those logs up on that flatbed truck by like going to where a switchback is in the road, and so we put the logs on the upper side, put the truck on, and rolled them onto the truck. And then up near the property line, we loaded on the truck by putting a cable across the road and a pulley system on, lifted up one end and pushed it up on the truck. But we got several thousand feet of cedar that there used to, where the, up here on the road, there used to be a sawmill in there, took them all up. They ran out all into cedar lumber. I took it into Spokane to a planer and had it all planed into paneling. So there was enough to do Briscoe's, which he bought the cedar from me. There was enough to do the whole basement of Dr. Stout's home and their new home to finish that off. Plus, I had some more left over that I ended up selling to a builder in Pullman. So it ended up working out. But I went to my friend, John Bowker, the FBI agent, and I said, why didn't you tell me what I was in for? Because, frankly, I lost my shirt on the whole deal. And he says, you needed to know that one by experience. He says, I knew that you weren't going to come out on that. So you find out why there are middlemen. But that was...
A wise man.
It was experience.
Wow. That is quite an experience, huh? So you're working for Briscoe.
Yes.
And is he paying you along the way? He said he would pay you.
He said he would pay me. Yes. Well, he never brought it up again. Mm. He had another son, Laurel, who lived down in Texas, and he taught at the University of Texas in Austin. He wrote textbooks, Spanish textbooks for high school. So he would come up in the summer, and he'd be editing and working on his books. And I ran by him once. I said, you know, your dad said he would pay me for the work I did over 3 hours a day, but he's never brought it up again. I'm thinking he was always talking about finances too, and I thought maybe didn't have it to do it. He says, oh, Dad does. You know, he says, that's not a problem. You can bring it up to him. But there was a really another neat thing about Laurel. The dad would always tell me what a great pianist this kid that he had as a kid, and I thought it was just the dad bragging him up until I heard him play. He was a phenomenal pianist. In fact, he was the pianist at the Church of the Open Door in Los Angeles, where J. Vernon McGee preached, who had a radio program for years called Through the Bible. But he was not just a wonderful pianist, but he was largely responsible for my becoming a Christian, because I watched his life. Now watch, I did. He had a wife who kind of henpecked him. I thought, how does he do that? How does he do that? He's just calm about the whole thing. But he was interesting to talk to. We ended up playing piano duets, some Dvorak Slavonic dances, and I've got some photographs of Laurel. I'd always hoped that some of the land he would end up with it, but one son froze everybody else out. But what was the question?
it's okay. Well, I was just wondering, you know, you were working for Briscoe.
Oh, the pay.
Yeah,
yes.
he wasn't yes. paying you. He never brought it back up again.
No. So I didn't worry about it because, again, it was by the middle of my second year of college, it wasn't costing me anything more. Remember I told you about that board up on the wall in the dorm that had everybody on the honor roll?
And yes.
And
you wanted to be on.
Yes.
Yes.
And I did. But what I found something else out. When you get good grades, you can get scholarships. They'll pay you to go to school. And then by the fifth year, I was a TA, so I was getting paid for teaching while I was going to school. I had the fellowship in graduate school, so that paid for everything. I went back to WSU, and I was teaching and working on that elementary ed degree, so it wasn't costing me anything to go to school. So I enjoyed the summer. To me, and I was running the lumberyard just on weekends now, Saturday.
So you
Sunday.
Weren't really thinking about the money at the time?
Not so much, no. Yeah. And it was okay. We were out in a shed one day, and there were, Cecil said, you know, he says, I think I'll, if the paper company who owned a lot of land around us, the Inland Empire Paper Company, will put a good road down into here, I'll sell them those three upper 80s. There were three 80s, and in between it was stuck was a, at that time it was Bureau of Land Management and ended up becoming Paper Company 80. And just out of the blue, I said, Cecil, would you sell them to me? No, I had no idea I would ever pay for something, but I was interested in the land. So he said, well, I'll ask my wife. So he asked his wife, and he said, what we want to do is ask our children, six children. So they did. Three of them said yes, three of them said no. So he says, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll sell you 80 acres. And it was the one furthest away. It also was the one that had the most timber on it. And
is that the one that the cabin is on now?
Yes.
Okay.
But even after I bought it, I had no idea where the property lines were. It was a while before I got it surveyed and why I needed to do that. All I knew is I had 80 acres. Well, now comes the idea, how much do you pay for it? How much is it going to cost? He went to a realtor, and the realtor said, is there water on the property? And I said, yeah. Or he said, Cecil said, yeah, and there were. There's several creeks on that part of it. The price immediately doubled to $45 an acre. $45 an acre.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
For 80 acres.
Okay.
So I'm at school, I'm paying for school, but I'm also tuning pianos now. My wife was also teaching. She was a second grade teacher in Seattle. And I said, Cecil, if I could pay that off in 5 years, would you sell it to us without interest? He said, yes. So there was the motivation. So there went piano tuning money and whatnot. And we did get it paid off in 5 years.
So you paid the $3,600 in five years.
Yep.
Okay.
We were able to do that. And of course, once it got the property, then it was off to the races to get a road in up to there. In fact, well, the first few years, it just lived in the clearing, lived in a tent. That's a whole other chapter of life, living in a tent during the summer.
Hmm.
The first year, probably about, it must have been, we bought it in 65, 66, 67. It was a very dry summer. It was the year of the big fires up at Priest Lake, I think, the Trapper Peak and Sundance fires, and all, I mean, they were huge, thousands of acres. The smoke came down, and it was a smoky summer. But in those days, there were also no dumpsters to go to or your garbage. So we just put it in paper bags behind the tent. We were living in a tent. At that time, that was it, and a pickup truck. And the way we made some money is I made some of the posts into, made some of the cedar into posts, and we sold them over to North Idaho Post and Pole. About $15 a week we made doing that. Well, on the 4th of July, we went across the lake. My sister had a cabin over there. We came back, and the place was absolutely trashed. Bears had come in. Just ripped the tent to shreds. We somehow, Anna just made some raspberry jam, and that was all broken up. And
so there were quite a few more bears on the mountain.
Yes, there is now. A whole chapter of my life would be all my bear experiences. That was the first one. Well, I told Cecil about it, went down, and kind of stayed at the cabin there because we had no tent to stay in now. And my wife, I think... it might have been Kristen, may have just been born, so it would have been 1968 then, and so she went over and lived with my sister across the lake while I worked and stuff. So Cecil, he said, well, let's go up in the next evening and see if the bears show up again, and maybe we can deal with them. So we're getting close to the clearing, coming around, and here are three bear rounding around in the clearing. Remember I told you Cecil's hard of hearing?
Uh-huh.
There they are! He shouts out, and the bears, they were gone. Yeah. So that was that summer. The next summer, I got a tent, and we lived further up in a clearing again. So there was 2 years in tent, and then I lived in the back of the truck, I think, at the time when Kristen was a baby. They kind of confused some things there. But then I got the land surveyed and found out, when I found out that where we ended up building houses, there was a little bit of land that was kind of flat in those big trees. That was, I had a road cut into there, had it cleared, and from then on it was all the work of building the cabin, putting in a garden, putting in the yards, and it took years just to get rid of the stumps. It was a lot of work.
Well,
that was summers. That was the next several summers. By the way, a couple of years later, Cecil said, would you like that? Now it was 100 acres because he had changed some things down at the bottom of the land. It's basically the canyon. Would you like that? And I said, how much? He said, $300 an acre. And I said, no. First of all, I didn't have $300 an acre. Plus, there was nothing on it to speak of. However, I will have to say that over the years, a whole forest grew up and it's been clear cut here 2 winters ago. But that was it. A couple of years later, I think we're talking 1974 now, he says, I'd like to see you have that 80 right next to you, the one that connects with you. I didn't care how much he was going to ask for it. I was going to take it. And I said, how much? He says, $200 an acre. I said, we'll take it. So I had to negotiate again how to do this. And by this time, they weren't going to want to come up in the summer any longer. They were getting pretty old. But they wanted a place kind of looked after, kept up. And I said, Cecil, if I make it look like there's somebody all the time, the boys and I will go down, we'll keep the lawn mowed, we'll keep it looking like somebody's there all the time. Would you sell it to me without interest? He said, yes. It took several years because the 200 now was 16,000. So Cecil never paid me for those hours I worked, you know, after 3 hours a day.
Uh-huh.
But I have to tell you, I got paid. We got paid very, very well. My guess is over the years, we've taken off probably 2 million feet of timber off that land.
Wow.
And it's still fully stocked, growing very well. I would say probably the boys that work for me make more money than I do because there's so many costs that go with logging. They're unbelievable. But
so 240 acres is what you have.
160.
I'm sorry, 160.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And it's, you actually end up with more because they survey it as if it were flat. And here it is all on the mountain. So there's
a little more. More.
It's also on a section line, which gives you a few more because of the curvature of the earth. So there's, but whatever it is, it's a lot.
Well, the cabin is just beautiful. And you actually have multiple cabins. You have the small cabin. You have a little cabin that's like it's like a single room cabin. And then you have the big cabin. So I mean, what was the situation there? Which one did you build first?
First thing I built was an outhouse. And it was down by the clearing. And then when the road got built up into the where the property was, first thing we built was that cabin. It's 16 by 24. It's got a porch, so the main room is 16 by 16. We had one child, Kristen, our daughter, in those years. And I split all the shakes myself, which I have for all of the buildings, out of long butts that the loggers left over the years. Also peeled the bark off of them, so it's all covered with cedar bark. It's big, thick. I mean, these cedar trees were hundreds of years old. But it was the only lumber that I ever went and bought from a mill. All the later buildings were built out of logs that I logged off the property. I took it and had cut out and planed. So that first cabin did us, and then the boys all came along, three boys, 2 years apart. Kristen was born in 68, the boys 72, 74, and 76. So the cabin obviously was not going to be sufficient. So I built a second smaller cabin, another small cabin, three of the kids stayed down there in that cabin. There was a loft upstairs, and two of them could be downstairs. About 1980 and 81, I decided to build a big home, bigger home. It never occurred to me to go get a generator. It was all built with hand tools. Yes, and it's a
big cabin.
Big cabin. It's got a daylight basement, two stories, and an attic up on top. Yeah, it took me 5 years to split all the shakes for it that are on it. It was a major production, but those were also the years that I was in a Christian school. Now I didn't have time to work on it, so it kind of sat there unfinished for several years.
So you were teaching at a Christian school?
I was then in the 1980s, yeah, in Rathdrum.
Yeah. You know, something that you taught us over the years that I just have to bring up when you're talking about the cabin is taking care of the things that you have.
Yes. It was a load of fun putting everything in, but eventually it's almost as those things possess you. We've got a huge garden, a couple of yards of lawns, and about 20 fruit trees.
Things grow very well up there.
Yeah, and you spend so much time on maintenance. Mm-hmm. Maintenance. And now at my age, 77, almost 78, it's overwhelming trying to take care of two places. So a lot of things are starting to deteriorate. Mm-hmm. The boys all have jobs that are full-time, so they can't do like I did, take the summer off because I was teaching, or I just stopped tuning pianos now and I take the summer and work up there. And so things like the fences that need replacing are deteriorating, other things. And I don't know what happens when I'm off of the scene, what's going to happen to the place.
Yeah.
Now. But the garden, I love gardening. It's a huge garden. And the fruit trees are a lot of fun, and of course it's far more than I need, so I take things with me in the fall and I give it to people I tune for, and I three boys and their families, so it all gets used, it all gets dealt with.
Yeah. So for people who have not been paying too much of attention, you're a piano tuner. You tune pianos in the wintertime.
Yeah, during the school year.
During the school year, yeah. And then you work on the mountain in the summer.
Right.
And so how many pianos do you typically tune every year?
Well, yeah, that's another thing is I haven't figured out how to cut back, to ease back, and I'm going to have to now. I'm going to have to do it somehow. But I cover a huge area. I still go down to the Palouse country 2 days a week, usually Tuesdays and Wednesdays. I stay in a retirement home in Colfax on Tuesday nights. I do about 200 pianos somewhere down in the Pullman, Moscow, Colfax, out on the farms, areas, and then I go as far north as Ione Medellin Falls in Washington, almost to the Canadian border, and Bonner's Ferry in Idaho. They're sort of like highway corridors I follow, and I do about 600 during the school year. So And there was a time until I taught one of my sons 20-some years ago to tune that there was a time when I was doing about 900 a year. When PJ started tuning, I gave him a lot of the work, and the only tuning he does now, because he's a full-time RN at the hospital in Post Falls where he works in the operating room. They just do surgeries all day that he works on. But he did keep the college in Coeur d'Alene, and I tuned to NIC, North Idaho College, for about 20 years and then gave that to PJ. So everything is kind of overwhelming now.
Yeah.
And especially with the numbers of surgeries I've had to fix things, I'm always trying to catch up then on the tuning. But I usually do 4 or 5 a day.
I mean, that's a large number of pianos.
It is.
You're one of the few people left in this area that tune by ear.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Well, you know, I tried tuning by ear, but it hurt so much I went back to using my hands.
I remember.
Okay, I know all the piano tuning jokes. Yeah. Yes, there aren't very many, and I think there's a reason. First one, it takes a long time to build up a clientele. Mm. I'd say 99% of my work is word of mouth, but it's a very solitary profession and requires an intense concentration.
Mm.
But it's not what I'd call high stress. Compared to teaching. In fact, when I was teaching in the Christian school, often I'd go out just to relax and I'd tune a piano or two in the evening. Many of the pianos I've done for many years, I can think of one lady I tuned for recently. She was in high school when I first started tuning for her in Pullman. She has a home in Pullman and one at Priest Lake, and I've tuned her piano for 56 years, as long as I've been tuning. And there are some other places where I've tuned that long.
I mean, there's a lot of clients that you have that... Yeah. Where are they going to go when you stop tuning?
Yes, that's what they... I've always said, you know, I hope I die before three people retire. My doctor, my dentist, and my mechanic. Unfortunately, they've all pretty much retired. And trying to find someone else is not easy.
Yeah.
So, and people tell me the same thing. What are we going to do when you're not here? Because, so you know, people who live in town, they'll be able to get another tuner. But so much of my work is far away. Because when I taught PJ, my son, I gave him all the close-in work. Because he has a family, I lived alone, so I did all the faraway work. So, you know, I drive probably a minimum 500 miles a week. It's 300 miles on Tuesday and Wednesday alone, depending on how much east and west. You kind of the highway corridors you follow, 195 from Spokane down through the Palouse country, Highway 95 from Moscow to Bonner's Ferry. Mm. And I send out letters twice a year with a self-addressed stamp cards and about 600 letters at a time. When those cards come back, I put them in order by the different areas that I go and in the order of when they get tuned. So I try to come about the same time each year. So I set up all my work a week at a time, because once the week starts, I just about live in my car.
You know, you mentioned your surgeries, and
yes.
I wanted to say that you are quite fit for your age, and that has come from a couple different things. I think that's come from your drive. You're a very hard worker, and you're always working, and you're always moving, and that has been very helpful in your life. But you were also a marathon runner.
Yes.
Tell me why, first of all, what got you into running and it became an obsession of yours that you've...
Almost, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Almost. First of all, I'd say something about the work ethic. If your parents went through the Depression, I can almost guarantee that you grew up with a work ethic. Because in those days, there weren't all of the social safety nets that there are now. And people who struggled to get through that, they passed that ethic on to their children. At least that's kind of how I see it. That's how I got that. But anyway, when I taught school, we had PE, and there was a play field that we went to. This when I was in a Christian school, that we would go to about a half mile away. And I could tell you, getting over there, I'd have to stop about three times. You know, and walk and breathe. I was up, my weight was up to about 210 pounds.
Mm.
I had to wedge myself between the bed and the wall to get my socks on. It wasn't good because I'm in my 40s now but I realized, you know, if I don't get myself into shape pretty soon, it's not going to happen. Well, Ann signed us up for a 5K in Rathdrum. I thought, this is going to be embarrassing. So I started, I think I better get into shape. I have a month or so. So I started running around the garden every day. I'd run about 10 minutes. It was agony for the first couple of weeks, just absolute agony. And I changed my diet. I said, I'm going to try to lose some weight. I believe it or not, I lost a pound a day until I lost 60 pounds that summer. I was down to 150 by the end of summer. But so I ran the first 5K I ever ran. And running that kind of hooked me on to running. I thought, I can do better. I can improve. And the whole idea was I can improve. So did a couple more 5Ks that summer. It was a good way to go visit towns that would have their celebration and they would have a run. Plus, they gave away, in those days, they gave away some really neat prizes after the race. I never got any, but I got, remember a guy at Rathdrum, he got the bike. He won a bike. And I saw him up at Kellogg and he got the main prize there, which was some silver medallions or something from Sunshine Mine. I said, what a deal. I got a twofer on that. But it was fun. And the whole family, we would go to these things because then they usually had some kind of a flea market afterwards of people that had goods that they sold. And after I did that for a couple of years, I got to thinking, I thought, I wonder if I could run a marathon, I could run that far. So I started kind of working up to it, joined the North Idaho Road Runners and got some good counsel, made some friends there. And I finally signed up for the Coeur d'Alene Marathon for the next year. It was probably about 47, 48 years ago when I ran it. And when I ran that first, I remember down by Sanders Beach, it's in the last mile or two, going over those speed bumps was like crawling over a wall. I mean, I was just dead shot, but I was hooked. That was the beginning. And I had 10 really good years in my 50s and actually into my 60s before some difficulties started to show up. But it was always, could I get faster? Could I improve? And it also became an excuse to go visit places. So I would start going down to Portland in October, early October, in Seattle around Thanksgiving. Loved going up in May to Vancouver, British Columbia. Ended up doing about six a year pretty quickly. And then I was getting down to pretty close to 3.5 hours. And I thought, it's an 8-minute mile. I thought, if I could do that, that would be a good lifetime goal. And then I found out that was the qualifying time for Boston. Now I'm really, really motivated. Well, in July, there was a 5-miler that I would do up at Priest River at the end of July. And afterwards, I said, something's gone wrong down in my abdominal area. I think I've done something. Well, I went and found out I had a hernia.
Oh.
So the surgeon said, if I do that surgery now, you'll never run in October in Portland to try to qualify for Boston. He says, but you can run with that thing the way it is now and see if you could qualify. So I remember I did a lot of my training on the track, Lakeland track, because I could run at night, keep track of miles easy, and I had my water right there. I stopped running on the county roads because they're crowned, and it was starting to cause trouble for my knees. But when I ran and ran on the track and it's rubberized, the knee problems went away.
Okay.
Well, the problem is sometimes the hernia, your innards would pooch out, and I'd have to lie down on the track and push them back in. Unfortunately, I didn't qualify that year. Anyway, so the runs are almost always on Sunday. On Monday, I went in to have the hernia surgery. The guy says, "I'll see me in a week." Well, I went up to the cabin, and I don't know whether it was probably from the running the day before, everything swelled up. That thing swelled up to the size of a grapefruit. I could barely move, and I didn't, turn black and blue on that right side. When I went back in there a week later, he says, "Man, it looks like I did that surgery with a ball peen hammer." But anyway, about a year or so later, I did qualify. And I was fortunate enough to be able to go back there 4 times to Boston. And what an experience, And I would take a week afterwards and travel through New England and stay in old bed and breakfast and go to old museums. I got to go to the Boston Symphony once, but they were really good years. My sister, my older sister Pat, went with me to a lot of runs. But by the end, last one I did was when I was 71, and I didn't realize at that time, but I also started doing a lot of half marathons, is that I had like a low blood sugar. was causing me grief. And once I figured out how to deal with that, it kept going. But I ran my last marathon when I was 71. Now it's probably mainly just because I got too many other things to do. But the running is pretty much over.
Do you remember off the top of your head your fastest marathon time?
Yeah, it's right there on the wall. It's the only one that had the finish time in the finish line. So I think I had four of them under 3.5 hours, and they were all like 3:27 or so. But you know, I was never a high mileage runner. I never really pushed it hard.
Yeah,
I just would put it in cruise control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I have heard, since I've come down with AFib, atrial fibrillation, that long distance runners are prone to that. So that may be the downside of those years of long distance running.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never heard that, but I guess it's something that wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. It surprised me when I got it.
It
was a jolt.
Yeah.
The shorter the race, the harder they are, because they become like full-bore sprints, where I say the marathon is just a cruise control. I always divided it up. The first 10 miles, you get down the road as quickly as you can using as little effort as possible. The second 10 miles, you just try to hold it. And the problem comes in with many people at 20 miles, because then you've usually run out of glycogen stores, unless you've done a lot of training over that, and you can kind of fool your body into thinking. And then the last 6 miles, if you got anything left, now you pour it on. If you can. But I usually divide that last 6 miles up. I can go one more mile. I don't think I've got 6 miles to go. And I can run one more mile. I can do one more mile. That's how I divide that up.
Interesting.
But I ended up doing 70-some marathons and probably 50 half marathons. Half marathons became much more common because you didn't have to train as long for as long as the runs. But half of it was the enjoyment of running. The other half was getting to go visit places, otherwise I'd just stay home and work. So, yeah, Chicago. I did Chicago Marathon, flat as a pancake. And, you know, in those big cities are the most fun. You ran through areas where you'd run for blocks and not see anything in English. It went around through Hollywood, and I was surprised, except for Rodeo, how depressed an area it is. Really depressing. I mean, on the boarded up windows, doors. There was always something to do after the run. Go and do some special thing, or whatever area it was in. It was fun going to Vancouver because of Stanley Park and other things that were there. It was fun going to Victoria. It was just a great excuse to visit places.
I had another thing that I really wanted to bring up to you, because when we started working for you, the first week that we worked for you, we were taking a break, or we were heading up to the cabin or something, and you started telling us that you were a storyteller and that you were practicing and preparing a story for a stage performance that you were going to be doing, and you asked us if you could test it out on us.
Oh.
And we were like, absolutely. And you lit into telling this story. And, you know, when you tell your stories, you're screaming, you're yelling, it scared the living daylights out of us.
When I was teaching elementary school, you in order to maintain your credentials, you had to take a certain number of credits every few years. And so one of the classes I picked was storytelling. It was at Coeur d'Alene High School. And our kids were fairly young then, and they had these records of Danny Kaye and telling stories. And one of the stories I picked for this class to do was called The Clever Gretel. That was kind of the beginning. But we'd also just lie in the lawn at night up at the cabin, and I would just make up stories to the kids, just improvise. I love improv. And one of them was about my favorite creature, the Berserkenheimer. Tree gobbles, brush snorts, you know. But my boys liked reading Pat McManus, an author of outdoor humor. And they would be laughing about him and Wretch and Strange and all of the creatures and people that he had in his stories. So I started reading them also, and I could see why people would laugh at his stories. My favorite story is Cigar Butts, Logging Trucks, and Know-It-Alls. So as it came up eventually, it would have like a talent show, and I thought, well, maybe I'll work up a story and tell it, and so I did. So there were number of venues in North Idaho that I could go to, and one of the first ones was out at the state line. They had a dinner theater out there, and they had a big, the Rock and Bee Ranch. They had a Christian music festival out there, and I went out there as entertainment in between to tell stories. And there was a Christian writer there, Frank Peretti, who was in one of the bands, played banjo. We did some things between us, and he was kind of my fall guy for my jokes, and I could tell he didn't appreciate it really well. I think he did. Anyways, but a lot of them were at church when they'd have a program in the spring. And of course, I was much different than most of what was showing up, but people seemed to get a kick out of it and seemed to think it was okay. But that was what I did. And oftentimes I would take maybe a part of a Pat McManus story, a paragraph or a couple, and I'd build a whole new story around it. Sometimes I would take his stories and just adapt them into my own way. And then I had all the ones that I just made up.
Mm-hmm.
That I just made up. Uphill skiing, for example. they were fun. And so eventually, I ended up doing a program up at Priest Lake, and where I was going to be the only one on the program for about an hour. And I thought, this is going to be challenging. And I had a good friend who agreed to video it. Oh, he's right in front of me, Aaron. Aaron was starting to make videos. So Aaron came up and videoed, made a video of that. And then he did some of his own creative work. He did some interviewing of the owner of the bed and breakfast where this occurred. Did some of his own creative work. And then there were some, at the end, several pictures of backpacking and camping that we did over the years just in the Priest Lake area. So it ended up being about an hour and a half program. And I've given away about 300 of those DVDs or so to people. In fact, I just sent one over to a brother-in-law here this last week. And I don't know whether it was a year or two later, we did another DVD with an apprentice that I had, a very gifted pianist. And I used my humor to set him up to play the piano. But yeah, I love those kind of whacked out stories. They're just, that's kind of my alter ego, maybe the real me.
You are so talented at telling stories, but even more so, you are talented at performance. You know, like Pat McManus, we've talked about this before. Pat McManus stories are just roll on the floor funny.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable how funny these stories are. But Pat McManus was never extremely good at stage performance.
Right. No, he didn't. And it was interesting because he would do a tours, and he was also a creative writer out at Eastern, but he was just like a normal person. He didn't have that, he didn't have the personality of all of his characters in his stories. And so it didn't really work very well.
Yeah.
For him, but he was a marvelous writer. Yeah.
Amazing. You're a very good storyteller. And maybe we'll play a little bit from one of those videos on this podcast.
Oh. It was a fairly uneventful until we crossed paths with old Grizz. David, I hope you don't hold it against the boys too much for dropping you and heading for the nearest tree. There's probably another reason why we shouldn't have lashed David so tight to that leader, because you know most Idahoans with two broken legs can shin up a tree faster than a squirrel when there's a grizz in a hot pursuit. But we all applauded real loud as David managed to stand up and stagger a few steps before toppling over. And then we all shut our eyes really tight, because them grizz, they can do some really nauseating stuff. Stuff you don't want to even think about, let alone watch. But fortunately, all that grizz did was come over and sniff David over real well. And David, you is to be commended for holding your breath the way you did there and lying there still and playing dead. But I got to suggest to David, the next time that happens, after the grizz leaves, you is supposed to start breathing again. Me and the boys, we drawed straws to get to see who's going to give you mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And I got to tell you, David, I was mighty relieved when you started breathing on your own. And that ain't just because I was holding the short stick either. You mentioned about the yelling and the screaming. Some parts of them, they can get pretty loud. And one time I was practicing out here in the living room, and the front doorbell rang. And it was the sheriff. And they said, step out, please, and make sure we see your hands. I thought, what? What's going on? They say, is there someone else in the house with you? Turned out my neighbor behind me thought somebody was getting murdered here or something. And he called the sheriff's department. And so they came in and went through the house. And I told him what I was doing. And it was okay. But
oh, that's so funny.
You could hear that clear through the walls and out there.
You know, one of the very, some of the special moments that I've had with you is backpacking in Canada, even more than that, going up to the old ghost town Sandon and Cody at the end of Slocan Lake, near the end, and spending time riding four-wheelers and motorcycles all over the mountain and finding old mines, one of them close to 100 years old that we crawled back into.
Well, I've gone into several of them.
Yeah, and you've done that for, you've been doing that for years. You used to do that with your kids.
30 years or more.
Mm-hmm. I know you told us a story of a mine that since has collapsed where you went in and actually rode the car. You'd take the old train car and you could push it back in.
Yeah. Some of them, they just walked away from them, left everything, all the equipment, all the vehicles they had, the front end loaders were all back in the mines. Those were fascinating years.
Do you have any specific memory when you were doing that with your kids that comes to mind?
Sometimes we would do things I would think, what am I doing up this far? It was usually not in the mines, although some of them could be dangerous. I tuned for a number of geologists, so I know what to look out for. If there's air moving through it, you know there's an opening above, and so you need to be kind of careful. But it was the climbing we would do around on the mountains above, or trying to get up onto glaciers or whatnot. I thought, if I fell down or something happened here, what would they do? How would the kids get me out of here? Those were more of the scary things, up at Monica Meadows in British Columbia.
Yeah, we're driving 2.5 hours or whatever on a dirt road in the middle of nowhere just to get to the trailhead, which then goes up to the meadows.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we would just take the car and go backpacking. And then we had a trailer. Sometimes we'd take the four-wheeler and a Honda 110 motorcycle, so we could have two on the motorcycle, two on the four-wheeler, and we would ride way up onto the ridges and then start hiking. And you could cover a lot of ground in a day. Kind of undergirding everything, though, everything that I do and everything I do is my Christian faith. That has to be paramount in my life. And so I'm always thinking in terms of, with especially with the young boys that I've worked with many of them over the years, is how are they going to remember, you know, working what we did together? What I hope mostly they get out of it is that it strengthens their Christian faith, because everything I do is motivated by the Christian way of life, the love for the Lord, love for His Word, and that's the singular goal in my life, is to have impact on people's life, and that with the relationships that we have. Maybe I mentioned this before, but I'm not going to miss tuning pianos one day, but I'm going to miss all the people that I've gotten to know over the years. I'm not going to miss logging one day, but I'm going to sure miss all the good times that we had doing whatever we were doing. And oftentimes it took, you know, everybody working together to get something done. I remember Jeff, he liked to kind of work by himself, but just problem solving, because I know the kids none of these kids are ever going to become loggers, but they're going to take what they've learned in problem solving and getting along with people into whatever they do in their life. And that is what I hope by the time their parents and grandparents, they look back and say, now I know why that guy was in my life.
Speaking to that, I've been running my own business for about a year and a half, and I cannot tell you, Mike, the amount of times that I am trying to figure something out in my work, and my mind goes back to the things that you taught us on the mountain. While logging on the mountain, things that, like you said, none of us were going to become professional loggers, but all of the different things that you taught us up there, it's really shaped us into who we are today. And you've been such a vital, You've played such a vital role in my life, and I know you've played a vital role in my brother's lives and in many other young boys' lives. And, you know, somebody recently told me, and I quote this, Mike is the guy that, to me, defines integrity. And I know you're modest, and you may try and contest that to some extent, but I really want to ask you, I really want to know, how do you define integrity? And also, is there an example of somebody who exhibits integrity that you can give us?
Yes, your integrity. I'm reminded that nobody can take your integrity away from you. They cannot do that. But you can give it away by how you conduct your life. It's just how you conduct your life. What kind of character are you? Honesty, compassion, all the good character traits that Jesus possessed. You know, that's what Christian is a little Christian, is to becoming like him. How you deal with people, how you talk to people, that you don't belittle them, that you build them up. Like I say, one of my chief goals is to make every kid that works with me successful. I want them to be successful in life. I want them to be successful when we're working together. And I'll do whatever I need to do to bring them to that point, you know. Oftentimes it has to do with getting them to make decisions. I remember one boy, I'd say, start out with something simple. Do you want to eat now or should we work another 20 minutes? And he'd go, I said, we're not going to do anything until you decide. So you force them into making. And eventually they learn how to do those things themselves. But keeping your word. And that's a kind of a hard one, because sometimes you say something, then you kind of wish you wonder whether you should. But once you tell somebody, your word is your bond. I maintain that. I don't need to make a contract with somebody. If I tell you I'm going to do something, it's going to happen. And,
you know, the dictionary definition of integrity is, you know, the quality of being honest and having strong moral principles.
Yes. And we live in a time when
moral principles are out the window.
Yes, the diversity doesn't mean when we in the church we have diversity of spiritual gifts, and that's the strength of the churches, are the differences that we have. Diversity to me means trying to accept some type of immorality, and you just can't do that. Now you don't have to be a boor about confronting it. But you have to take it. You have to stand on the principle at some point. If it costs you, no matter what it costs you, you do what's right no matter what.
And that's something that we're lacking in our society, and it's getting worse all the time, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, what we hope is that people see the light, and it's the heart of man that needs to be changed. No matter what laws you have, you can't change people's character by the laws, but it has to reach the heart. And when there's a heart change, then things will change, and we need it desperately in our country. Remember something my mom said once. Religion is what man tries to do for God. The problem is you can never do enough. Christianity is what God has done for man, and what he's done is a done thing. So in most religions, they're always trying to do something of human effort to merit approval with God. In a Christian life, we live by grace. Grace is what God has done for us, and that we can't merit, wheedle, cajole, or anything, or deserve anything from Him. What He gives to us is by His grace, and we treat one another in grace.
I have one big question left, I would say, and that is, I want to talk about legacy and what legacy means to you. I know yesterday we were talking about, you know, your life and what you want to leave behind.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, with everything we do, all that we do, whether what we say, how we think, how we relate to people, we're always building a legacy, something that we're going to leave behind for the next generation, whether it's your children or your grandchildren. And I think that's really important. I think about what people have left to me that went ahead of me, and how important it was what I saw in their life, because it kind of determined who I became. And so integrity and leading to a good legacy, so you don't have any regrets when you go. to be with the Lord.
How do you want people to remember you?
Well, I think the one that you mentioned, integrity, had integrity. I'll be very thankful if that's what it is. But also that I hope they. I'm hoping at my if there's a memorial, they play the video "Real Idahoans Goes Camping," because got to have a sense of humor in life too. I believe God has a sense of humor and a number of examples of that. But yeah. Enjoy your life. Just have a good time with it. By golly, that's. Been very thankful. I think in the challenges I've got medical now are really bringing out that in everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. In everything give thanks. Sometimes these things I can't figure out exactly, but I just know that since God already knew it, he knew it in his omniscience that I was going to end up with these medical problems, it's fine. I'm fine with it. You live long enough, something's going to go eventually. I mean, none of us get out of here without something going haywire. So it's okay. You just adapt to it.
Yeah.
You adapt to it.
Yeah.
And,
Well, I just, again, I know I've said this before, but you've been such a strong pillar in my life, and I really have appreciated you and everything that you've done for me in my life, and I want that to be recognized.
Yeah. Well, you know, it works both ways, Aaron. You've had a very good influence on my life. Plus, you give me plenty of opportunities to share with people. Let me tell you about this kid who worked for me. The success, especially if it's somebody who's struggling, I can share that with it. So the joy has been all mine too. It's something to be very, very thankful for. Mm-hmm.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to wrap it up. I did have one, unless you had anything else that you'd like to share, any more thoughts that you have?
You know, all of my stories end with the same line. This is the old piano tuner saying, whatever you does heartily unto the Lord. You hear?